Okay, it's time for Bigler's World. That's going to make me Jim Bigler for the next hour. Got all kinds of magazines here. Got some time for kids. Going to start out with that. What else do I have? Science News Explores. That's also for kids, I think. Anyway, let's start here with this Underground Artifacts article by Lillian Stone from Time for Kids. It's a short article, but it's really good. It's a quality article. Imagine seeing ancient treasures on your way to work or school. Greece's second largest city, which I've never heard of, Thessaloniki, has made that a reality. The city has opened a new subway system that showcases ancient artifacts dug up during its construction. The subway opened on November 30th. It has been under construction since 2003. As workers tunneled through the city, they found more than 300,000 artifacts spanning many centuries. Pieces are now on display along the underground network of 13 stations. Christos Starikouras, he's the transport and infrastructure minister of Greece. He told reporters that the project
offers a remarkable blend of ancient, modern, integrating archaeological heritage with metro infrastructure.
They integrated it. It's all been integrated. Let's see. The End of Eris is the next article here, sticking with Time for Kids. Lillian Stone put this together as well. Taylor Swift. You ever heard of her? Just wrapped up the highest grossing concert tour of all time. In December of 2023, the pop star's Eras Tour became the first concert tour to make more than $1 billion. But Swift still had months to go and hours to go before she slept. The tour, which started in March of that year, 2023, ended this year on December 8th. After 21 months and 149 shows, Swift smashed her own record. The tour sold more than $2 billion in tickets, per the New York Times. That amount doesn't include other profits from the tour, such as T-shirt sales, nor does it include ticket sales from Swift's concert movie, Taylor Swift, The Eras Tour. The film allowed fans to experience the concert even if they were unable to catch a show in person. It became the highest-grossing concert film of all time, bringing in more than $261 million after its release in October of 2023. Swift's touring company told The Times that a total of 10,168,008 people attended the tour. It impacted cities around the world. Tourists visited local businesses, including hotels and restaurants, boosting economies. Some people called this the Taylor effect. During her final Eras show, Swift described the tour as the most thrilling chapter of my entire life to date. She told fans, "You're why this is so special." And at the bottom it says, "Stop and think. How does the author use numbers to communicate the impact of the Eras tours?" Why are they asking me that? Why are statistics useful when telling a story like this one? Well, I'm going to have to get back to you on that. Okay, let's go to another magazine here on Bigler's World. Let's do a little Science News Explores. A landslide in Greenland, it's a Greenland fjord, echoed around the Earth for 9 days. The tsunami it triggered was as high as the Statue of Liberty, says Douglas Fox, who wrote this article. A mountainside in Greenland collapsed catastrophically into the ocean last year. The landslide triggered a wave as tall as the Statue of Liberty. This wave, a tsunami, was 50 miles down a fjord there. Its rapid and violent motion ripped up the coastline, and its vibrations were so violent that they were detected worldwide. Indeed, they rang the planet like a seismic bell every minute and a half for 9 straight days. The good news, no one was hurt. Large tourist ships ventured into that same fjord on the days before and after the tsunami. They were ferrying people on and off a beach with small boats, according to Christian Svenneveg. I'm Christian Svenneveg, and this is what he said. It was pure luck that no one was there when it happened, he says. The powerful wave would have easily capsized the small boats and swept the people away. Svenneveg is a geologist at the Geological Survey in Denmark and Greenland, otherwise known as the GEUS. He is based in Copenhagen, Denmark. He led a team that investigated the event. They now believe that Earth's warming climate set off the massive landslide that started it all. They described their findings September 13th in Science. Aside from those caused by the earthquake and volcanoes, most landslides around the world you can tie to climatic factors, says Svenevig. And as Earth keeps warming, he worries, this dangerous event could be a warning of worse things to come. Diagnosing the mystery ringing. Saturday, September 16th, 2023, started normally enough. But then at 11:35 a.m., sensors in Asia and North America picked up a sharp seismic signal. They detected waves rippling from a remote part of Greenland's east coast. Earthquakes typically cause such vibrations, but explosions, tsunamis, and volcanoes can, too. Initially, the source here was unknown. The next day, tourists on a cruise ship noticed damage to an abandoned research station on East Greenland's Ella Island. Equipment that was stored on land, including a boat and a truck-sized shipping container, had been washed into the sea. Svenevig, he heard the reports when he arrived at work Monday morning. Suspecting a tsunami, he looked through recent satellite images of the area. He hoped they would offer clues, and they did. For many kilometers along Dixon's Fjord, vegetation had been erased from the shorelines. At Ella Island, the plants had vanished to heights as much as 4 meters or 13 feet above the water. Further west and inland, plants were missing to higher and higher coastal elevations. A huge wave must have come from the west, Svenevig realized. It would have started out tall and gradually shrunk as it rolled east. That afternoon, he and several of his colleagues homed in on its source. Spied by eyes in the sky. Two satellite photos taken September 15th and 17th showed that small mountain ridge near the west end of the fjord had vanished. A frozen glacier had sat on the foot of this ridge some 45 miles from Ella Island. Somehow the lower reaches of that glacier had been pulverized. The collapsed ridge had smashed down onto the glacier below. It released some 25 million cubic meters, or 880 million cubic feet, of rock and shattered ice. The volume of the debris was equal to 10,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools. This rock and ice tumbled off the end of the glacier and into the fjord's water. The resulting splash threw 650 feet up the nearby mountain slopes. The wave it triggered was 360 feet tall. It may have sped along the fjord at 100 miles per hour or more. But there wasn't just a single wave. No, Chevy. This explosive event provoked a repeating wave called a seish. There it is. I'm going to say seish. It resembled a back and forth sloshing of water in a bathtub. Except here it was way bigger, echoing through the fjord every 90 seconds for 9 straight days. A loss of icy glue. Though sudden, the catastrophe was caused by changes that have been slowly happening for decades. Earth's warming climate has shrunk the glacier by Dixon's Fjord over time. No one knows how quickly it was losing ice, but the other glaciers in this part of Greenland have thinned by as much as 490 feet since the year 1900. As the glaciers thinned, they bear fragile mountain slopes that their ice had previously supported, and this appears to be why the ridge at Dixon's Fjord collapsed, Svenevig says. It lost that icy support. He fears such disasters could be more common as Greenland and other Arctic sites warm. Since 2017, Svenevig has used satellite images to map more than 500 landslides along Greenland's coasts. Some happened thousands of years ago, others crumbled as recently as 2021. In warmer parts of the world, heavy rains often trigger landslides, but a warming of permafrost caused many of the recent ones in Greenland. And here's how. As long as the temperature inside the mountain is no warmer than minus 10 degrees Celsius, that's 14 degrees Fahrenheit, the ice within it acts as cement. It glues bits of rock together. But if the permafrost warms up to around 30 degrees Fahrenheit, the ice will change. This is Svenningsson explaining. He says it actually starts to deform, like plastic or Play-Doh. Now individual rock bits no longer stick together. This can allow part of the mountainside to collapse. Indeed, at the sites of new landslides, he often sees rectangular blocks of frozen rock and gravel within the wreckage. Those house-sized icy blocks slowly thaw and crumble. The result of warming climate. Elsewhere, melting ice has caused similar disasters. In 2016, two mountain glaciers in Tibet suddenly collapsed. Gradual warming weakened the ARU-1 and 2 glaciers until their ice could no longer hold onto the mountain. The debris from this disintegration sent enough snow and ice cascading into the valley to fill 60,000 Olympic swimming pools. The ice and snow traveled up to 5 miles from its source. Along the way, it killed 9 herders and hundreds of livestock. Melting Himalayan glaciers create a different hazard, too. Vast lakes of meltwater have formed behind huge rock piles at the ends of the glaciers. These lakes can suddenly burst out of their fragile natural dams. The resulting outburst floods can gush tens of kilometers down through any valley below, sweeping people away, homes, bridges, and animals. But landslide tsunamis are especially worrisome because they often happen at sites with more people. In 1936, one roared through Lake Lavatnet in Norway. It swept away 2 villages, killing 74 people. And in 1958, a wave at Lituya Bay, Alaska, struck 3 large fishing vessels. One capsized and sank. One was tossed onto a hillside and destroyed. And the third was tossed over a narrow strip of land and into deeper water. That boat, its captain, and its 10-year-old son somehow survived. More recently, in 2017, landslide tsunami flooded a village in western Greenland, killing 4. But the risk of such an event around cruise ships that venture into fjords could prove especially catastrophic. See, who is this? Catherine Barnhart. She's a geologist at the U.S. Geological Survey in Golden, Colorado. She says, that is something that we definitely think about a lot. She studies landslide and tsunami risks in Alaska's Prince William Sound. Much like Dixon's Fjord, in Greenland, steep mountains line its narrow branching bay, and here too, glaciers are shrinking. Detailed studies like the one Svenvig just published will help Barnhart accomplish a difficult task. Building a computer program that can predict the size of a tsunami that a potential landslide might cause. Building up an inventory of events that have happened is really valuable, she says. Worse to come? The latest discovery leads Svenvig to worry about things that could become worse, far worse. 2 years ago, one of his collaborators, that's the word, noticed something strange. At the time, Matthew Owen was a marine geologist at Aarhus University in Denmark. He was building sonar maps of the sea floor in Vigate Strait. It's a narrow ocean channel off western Greenland. These 3D seafloor maps were being made to help scientists predict how future tsunamis would move through the water. As Owen assembled the maps, he noticed several large mounds on the bottom of the channel. Each covered many square kilometers. They looked like the mounds that a landslide would drop, except much bigger. Strewn along the seafloor were rectangular rocks of the size of skyscrapers. Recalls Owen, some of these individual blocks were bigger than the recent landslide that killed people, recalls Owen. He now works at the global maritime company in England that builds offshore wind energy farms. When Owen showed these maps to Svenvig, they noticed something important. Each mound sat in front of a massive valley
carved into the mountains above. Until then, no one had dared to think that those gouged valleys might be due to landslides. "They were just too big to comprehend," says Svenvig. "Some were up to 100 times larger than the recent landslides. One had dumped up to 2 cubic miles of rock onto the seafloor. That's enough to build 2,800 stacks of rocks the size of the Empire State Building. Those landslides would have triggered enormous waves, many hundreds of meters high. Even 60 miles from where they formed, he found, waves had tossed rock and gravel as high as 230 feet up onto land. At a similar distance, recent tsunamis like the one at Dixon's Fjord had risen only about 1/20th that high. These gigantic landslides likely happened at the end of the last ice age, some 7,000 to 10,000 years ago. That's when glaciers were retreating, and this rapid change destabilized the mountains. The Arctic's present-day warming could set the stage for a repeat of this, says Svenvig. "We should prepare for a future where these giant landslides can become a reality again."
Okay, let's do one more article from Science News Explorers. This one entitled, "To Stay Cool, Some Future Homes May Build on Past Power-Free Tech. Clever roofing, walls, and vents cool by moving heat and air without electricity," says Daya Dwarakanath. I think that's how you pronounce that. What does it say here? This is another in our series of stories identifying new technologies and actions that can slow in climate change, reduce its impacts, or help communities cope with rapid changing world. Here's the article. "Today, many people regularly live with dangerous summer heat. To stay cool, most rely on air-conditioned buildings. But this AC is an energy hog. And the electricity that powers it not only spews climate-warming gases, but also raises energy bills. In tackling this challenge, two research teams have looked to the past. They are combining some classic cooling concepts with new ideas. Their designs suggest how coming generations might build homes that deal with heat without being too costly. One of these groups is at Columbia University in New York City. This team has designed walls that aren't flat, but zigzagged. They can be attached to the outside of regular walls. The new siding looks a bit like those accordion pleated shades for windows. One half of each pleat faces other, the other half points down. On outer walls, each half of the pleats would be covered with a different coating. They work together to help keep the building's interior cool. A very different project, tested in California, builds with conventional straight walls, but they're made from some especially thick and dense material. It might be brick, stone, or adobe. Vents and other openings in the building's structure allow air to flow through it naturally. The flowing air eventually mixes warm, buoyant air with dense, colder air. This natural ventilation draws in plenty of outdoor air to keep indoor rooms from getting stale. Both designs keep their cool passively. That means they rely on no moving parts, explains Eric Teitelbaum. They also use no electricity or other form of power. Teitelbaum, a thermal engineer at AIL Research in Hopewell, New Jersey, did not take part in either project, but he works on green alternatives to air conditioning, so he's familiar with the idea of passive cooling. Reshaping walls, zigzags and all. "Compared to flat walls, accordion pleated siding reflects ground heat better," notes Kuai-Long Cheng, who led the Columbia project. "In summer," he notes, "the ground often is much hotter than the air. For instance, where the ground might be around 140 degrees Fahrenheit, a building's walls may be only about 86 degrees Fahrenheit. Straight walls might reflect some solar energy up into the sky," Cheng says, "but at the same time, they could be picking up heat from the ground," explains this mechanical engineer, who recently moved to Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana. To test this accordion-pleated siding, the Columbia group taped a zigzag-shaped aluminum frame to a thin, flat plastic wall.
A clear, stretchy silicone polymer coated the upper facing of each pleat. The researchers glued a thin, highly reflective sheet of mylar, a plastic film, onto the downward-facing side of each pleat. Then they tested this model outdoors. They also included a model of a flat wall made from materials that emit heat as well. Both models were left outside in New Jersey for 24 hours on a warm August day. The temperatures of the pleated wall siding varied across the day, but on average it was cooler than the flat wall by 4.1 degrees Fahrenheit. At its best, it was 5.6 degrees Fahrenheit, cooler than the flat wall. A cooler wall means less heat was transferred through the wall to the warm interior. The team used a computer model to calculate that the indoor temps would likely be 4.1 degrees Fahrenheit cooler. That might not sound like much. In fact, that notes Zhen Yulu, that this is a significant improvement, said Zhangji Lu. She's a mechanical engineer at Purdue. In passive cooling for buildings, she notes, even a few degrees of indoor temperature reduction can improve comfort. It also can save energy. In those initial tests, the accordion pleated siding had a cooling power of 30 to 67 watts per square meter, meters 10.8 square feet, of exterior surface. This could reduce the need for any extra cooling. A lesson from older times. Rather than walls, the second design focuses on roofs and how air flows indoors. Its passive radiative cooling draws from ancient designs used throughout many hot, dry parts of the world. Think the Middle East or the U.S. Southwest. Long before there were air conditioners, ancient builders tinted or painted roofs and walls light colors to reflect the sun's warming rays back into the space. These old homes also had thick, dense walls. The walls would absorb indoor heat by day and release it to the outdoors slowly at night. That slow release kept indoor air from getting too cold. The team drew from these classic ideas. Then it added a few modern innovations, explains Salomon Craig. This building scientist at the University of California, Los Angeles, led the project. For one, his group topped the structure's roof with a high-tech cover. It reflects the sun's warming rays while also emitting thermal energy that had been stored in the building. Then they designed strategically placed vents to allow air to move in and out. This set up a controlled mixing of warm and cool air. Promising results. To test how well this design might keep interior spaces cool, Craig's team built a pair of small model homes. One included all the new features. The other model included features and materials found in most of today's home, although with no AC. Then they placed four water bottles inside each model. The water absorbs and releases heat well, so these bottles acted as the thermal mass for the structures. Like the thick walls of ancient buildings, this mass absorbs indoor heat. Each model then was left for 2 days at a sunny desert site in Topanga, California. Sensors measured floor indoor heat and airflow in and out of each home. The new design stayed, on average, 2.9 degrees Fahrenheit cooler inside than the outside air. In contrast, the standard design was 7.7 degrees Fahrenheit warmer, on average, than the air outside. These results were good, but indoor temperatures kept going up and down like a roller coaster. They varied by 12 degrees Fahrenheit over the day. To fix that, the team added two more water bottles to each home. This greater thermal mass helped indoor temps remain more stable, and the test home now drew in twice as much fresh air and expelled twice as much stale air as before. The average indoor temp was now 7 degrees Fahrenheit cooler than outside, and it was, 16 degrees Fahrenheit cooler than the air in the standard home model. Cautious enthusiasm for the new findings. Both the Columbia and California designs show real promise, says Liu at Purdue. And the latter one should be easier to maintain. than a home with AC, adds Purdue mechanical engineer Yun Zhang. She says this should be because move-in ready model doesn't exist yet, and a test home does, but it's only the size of a carry-on suitcase. Zhang would also like to see studies to learn how dwellers might like them. Until someone tries to live in a full-sized structure, she explains, I don't know if it's comfortable. The Columbia team developed a new all-season design to make its house more effective and comfortable year-round. The angles of pleats on its zigzag siding can be varied depending on the season. They can be adjusted to maximize cooling in the summer and warming in the winter. These designs won't work equally everywhere. For instance, Note Zhang and Teitelbaum, neither is well-suited for wet, humid areas, such as Atlanta, Georgia. The designs work best in places that are both hot and dry. Think Phoenix, Arizona, or Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Craig acknowledges these limitations. The findings, he says, should be seen as part of a spectrum of solutions. What's worrying is where air conditioning is pushed as the only solution.
Okay, let's go over to another publication here. What do we got? News for kids. Bum, 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 bum. Let's see. This is an older story. I did not read this, but they did kind of a year in review here, going back to September. 16-year-old student builds nuclear fusion reactor. And that's not supposed to scare me. Cambridge, England. Cesar Menacarini. Mencarini, there it is. He recently graduated from a sixth form school, that's a high school in England, with excellent grades. But he was probably more excited about the success he had the previous year, building a working nuclear fusion reactor at the age of 16. And they have a little box here that says fusion. Fusion energy is created when hydrogen atoms fuse together or join. This reaction is what gives the sun and other stars their incredible energy. Many people see fusion energy as the perfect energy for the future. The fuel needed for fusion reactions is cheap, and there's plenty of it. And if scientists can figure out how to make it work, fusion could easily provide all the energy the world needs with very little pollution. But the goal of creating usable fusion power is still a long way off. Cesar, he grew up in Italy, but he's been going to school at Cardiff Sixth Form College in Cambridge, England, for the past 2 years. His focus was on math, chemistry, and physics. Cesar's mother is an architect, and his father is an electronic engineer. As a child, Cesar became interested in electronics. He loved to experiment. He learned to program computers and devices like the Arduino. Is that what it is? And Raspberry Pi. He also worked with a 3D printer. At Cardiff, Cesar was allowed to choose an extra area of study. After seeing a video about someone building a fusion reactor, Cesar decided he wanted to build one too. The school wasn't so excited about the idea, but Cesar worked to persuade his teachers. Finally, after a complete safety review and with extra advisors offering to help out, the school agreed. Cesar was a strong student, but his regular classes weren't teaching him how to build a fusion reactor. To learn this, he spent countless hours doing research, looking up information on the internet, and watching videos. And he says, "We're living in an age where everything is available just by searching," he says. When he faced a problem, he would read, watch 10 or 15 videos, and then go to try to tackle the problem. He also joined a website where he got advice from scientists with more experience. Step by step, working long hours with his physics teacher and his advisor, Cesar built the reactor. And last June, at the very end of the school year, the reactor was finished. One important step in building a fusion reactor is to achieve plasma. That's when atoms are so excited or heated up that they gain or lose electrons, creating a glowing gas called plasma. But Cesar still couldn't get the reactor to achieve plasma. A special piece of metal that was supposed to fit perfectly in the device didn't fit well. The seal kept leaking. Finally, Cesar and the others decided to try filing down the piece of metal by hand. That failed 4 times. The team was almost ready to give up, but the next time the seal held and the reactor worked,
creating plasma. Cesar could hardly believe his eyes. "It works," he cried excitedly.
"It's alive."
Over a year has passed since then. Cesar has continued to improve the reactor. He's built complicated devices to control the pressure and to better see and understand what's going on inside the reactor. He's one of the youngest students to have built such an advanced fusion reactor. But for sure, Cesar wasn't just about the reactor. It was about learning by doing and making connections with other people doing similar things. College is the next stop for Cesar, perhaps in England, perhaps in Italy. No matter where he goes, he'll probably continue to change people's ideas about how much young people can achieve. It's got a thing at the bottom here. One problem. Did you know one problem Cesar faced was money? The school approved his project, but they only gave him 25% of the money he needed. Cesar says that not having much money meant he had to be very creative, and as a result, he wound up learning much more. Okay, let's go to Frontiers for Young Minds. Right here on Bigler's World.
The Sun Sounds of Arizona.
This article is entitled Walkable Communities for a Healthier Planet, Exploring 15-Minute Cities. I swallowed the last one. Cities. Who wrote this? Sabrina Alzarini and some other kids, but we're just going to read this. What are our current cities like? They ask right off the bat here. Let's see, in a normal city, most amenities like shops, services, and entertainment are placed in the center of the city. Around the city are suburbs where only houses are built and where most people live. It may sound like a good idea to separate land based on its uses. There it is. But because of the separation, residents of this type of city are very dependent on car ownership to get anywhere. For instance, if someone wants to have a dinner at a restaurant, they need to have a car since there are no restaurants near their house. Although these types of cities might have proper sidewalks, they are rarely pedestrian-friendly, making walking difficult and causing people to rely on cars. Large amounts of land are also required within the city to build highways and car parking, which makes the city even less walkable. How did 15-minute cities come about? Well, the idea of 15-minute cities has existed for a long time, but the term was officially coined by Professor Carlos Moreno back in 2016. 15-minute cities became popular during COVID-19 when many restrictions limited where people could go. Many people could not access the services they wanted, and the pandemic made it more difficult for people to move around. This caused lots of people to leave large cities and move to less crowded ones, where transportation was easier and faster. The pandemic led to an increase in the use of private cars, especially in the suburbs. But when the pandemic subsided, many people moved back into cities. This is because of the easily accessible and well-located amenities that were not present in the suburbs. Getting from one place to another was one of the obstacles that people encountered after moving back to the cities, so they wanted more efficient transportation systems. 15-minute cities became a way to achieve the goal of having both good transportation and access to amenities. There are some characteristics that every 15-minute city should have. First, it's connectivity, which means connecting neighborhoods by public transportation so they are not separated from each other. Second is proximity, which means that most services must be 15 minutes away, maximum. Third is diversity. The city should contain mixed-use land instead of single-use land, which means the land has shops and homes together instead of separated. Finally, these cities should have density, which means clustering people and places in a specific area. Importance of walkability. 15-minute cities aim to be walkable so that people can walk or cycle to most places. These cities are designed for people rather than cars. This can be done by building pedestrian-friendly streets, which includes planting trees, preventing cars from using certain roads, and reducing speed limits. Walkable communities, where people can walk or cycle to their errands, encourage people to rely less on private cars. This means that a walkable community will produce less carbon emissions than a car-dependent city. 15-minute cities, as depicted in Figure 1, they got a thing here, are designed so that transportation journeys are short and therefore only small amounts of emissions are released per trip. Walking is free, so people who walk save money. Spending on car ownership, repairs, parking fees, and fuel are all reduced or eliminated. Governments also have large sums of money because they do not need to build and repair highways and roads. Governments can earn money as more people opt to pay for public transportation. This money can be reinvested back into the 15-minute city. Walkability paves the way for more social interactions between people, helping a community to form, whether that involves friends walking to a coffee shop together or saying hi to another person walking their dog. Walking is a physical activity associated with healthier populations because it decreases heart disease and obesity and even improves mental health. Examples of 15-minute cities. Paris, a crowded and polluted city, is implementing the 15-minute concept, which will allow the city to reduce pollution caused by cars. Many people in Paris travel across the city to get to work, which causes traffic jams and excess emissions. The La Ville du Côte d'Azur project, meaning the 15-minute city, is now being used to reduce the distance between offices, restaurants, schools, supermarkets, stores, and other amenities, making each Paris district self-sufficient. There will also be less need to travel outside a personal district for those services. To achieve this goal, Paris plans to construct a cycle path on every single street to encourage bicycle use. Paris will also use nature-based solutions, including green roofs, parks, and permeable pavement, to reduce the risk of extreme weather events like excessive heat and flooding. The Line is an upcoming 105-mile-long vertical city, built, as the name suggests, in a line from the sea to the inland mountains in Saudi Arabia. The city will have no cars or roads and will use 100% renewable energy. Green spaces like parks will be only 2 minutes away from anyone living in the Line. All the services people need will be accessible within 5 minutes of their home. The Line has a high-speed rail connecting all the communities, and it takes only 20 minutes to travel from beginning to the end. The Line project aims to be the epitome of sustainable city development and act as a model for the world. Okay, what have they got here? How are 15-minute cities healthier for the planet? I'm sure you're asking yourself. 15-minute cities, like many cities, are designed with mixed-use land. That means that one plot of land houses supermarkets, sports facilities, and other shops will all be present next to each other. This is the opposite of single-use land, in which the land is only used for one type of purpose. Mixed-use land can make the journey between the two locations much shorter. However, many places are too cold or too warm to walk or cycle all year round. Additionally, because of climate change, more extreme weather events are occurring, including hurricanes, droughts, and floods. These extremes make walking and cycling impossible. That's why it's important to have strong, efficient public transportation networks in 15-minute cities. When the weather is bad, or if someone does not want to or cannot walk to their errands, they can use public transportation instead of buying a car. 15-minute cities have fewer roads and car parking lots. This results in free spaces that can be used to build green spaces like parks. Green spaces are beautiful because they help to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Beneficial is what I meant to say. It's beautiful too, I guess. And it cools the air. The trees also act as air filters, cleaning pollutants from the air and improving air quality. So what are the limitations of 15-minute cities? It is difficult for governments to change how a city is designed because there are laws regulating how land is used and how a city is meant to be organized. For example, some areas have zoning laws that make a plot of land single-use, such as only for houses. If someone wants to build a supermarket on this single land use, it is very difficult and may take years for the government to allow it, if at all. So imagine if people want to transform a large area of single-use land into mixed-use land for a 15-minute city. To do so, the zoning laws need to be modified, which is difficult and time-consuming. It is also a lot of work and very expensive to transform a traditional city into a walkable city because a lot of the city's infrastructure needs to be changed. Agriculture and industries will be located far away from 15-minute cities. This means that many resources people need every day will need to be transported into 15-minute cities from other cities or even other countries. Long-distance transport produces a lot of carbon emissions, illustrating that it is very difficult for a city to be a true 15-minute city. These limitations are just a few of the difficulties 15-minute cities face. Further research must be conducted to overcome these limitations and make these cities a more realistic idea that can be applied around the world. Final takeaways. 15-minute cities are a method of planning cities in which most of a person's daily necessities are located nearby. They stress the importance there is of walking, cycling, and discouraging private use of cars. Many cities around the world, such as Paris, are implementing 15-minute cities to reduce pollution and traffic jams caused by cars and to shorten the journey between a person's home and the services they need. Multiple cities are being encouraged to take on the 15-minute city concept to make city life more livable. And then it asks, what are your ideas to make a city more like a 15-minute city? Okay, next up here on Bigler's World, let's go to a PBS NewsHour classroom article. Student Voices. When it comes to invention, don't be afraid to ask for help. That's the name of this article here. Ifeoma Okolo and Austin Ewing, 10th grade students from Chicago, Illinois, are actively learning about intellectual property, or IP, through their experience as student inventors and budding engineers. We're big thinkers. They got a picture of them here. Okolo and Ewing are still learning about intellectual property, but they find the concept incredibly intuitive. They compare the concept of IP ownership to ownership of physical property, an important achievement in the United States. These students see ownership of ideas as no different. Owning intellectual property is like owning anything else, like a car or a house. What you own is yours, says Okolo. Ewing agrees. Creativity isn't a tangible item that you can physically protect like your car or house. Even though a person can't take away your creativity, they can steal the product of your creativity, and people should know that there are ways to protect that. While his team of young inventors have the unique experience of creating an invention, they encourage all students to learn more about intellectual property, no matter where their interests lie. Even if a student doesn't do what we did and make an invention and enter it into competitions, intellectual property is still valuable for them to learn, says Okolo. All knowledge is valuable to have. Teaching students intellectual property in schools would encourage them to push boundaries and make them less afraid to try new things. Ewing notes that it's especially important to expose students to IP when they are young. The younger people are, the more creativity they tend to have. So it's important that these students know that they can get something out of their ideas. It's important for them to know that their ideas are so important that they can actually be protected because it will encourage them to harness their creativity and actually go far with bringing their ideas to life. Let's see, they got a quote from Okolo, 10th grade students. Don't be afraid to make it happen and don't be afraid to ask for help. Both students stress how important learning is to them and that many students their age crave new transferable skills and knowledge to apply in real-world scenarios. If educators teach students real-world skills and knowledge like intellectual property, even if it's something that's not traditionally or typically taught, it will ultimately help students in the long run, says Ewing. Okolo agrees. Part of a teacher's job is to help their students learn, grow, and develop into people who can think for themselves by giving them skills to use in the real world. Intellectual property is just one way to do this. For other students hoping to get started on inventing and learning about intellectual property, Okolo encourages, don't be afraid to make it happen. Don't be afraid to ask for help, which I read that earlier. Let's see, who is this talking? Ewing says, don't sign it off as something you can't do before you even think about it. Encouraging both educators and students to frame inventing and intellectual property ownership as achievable pursuits. While Okolo and Ewing themselves still have more to learn about intellectual property, the experience of creating an invention has inspired them to aspire towards IPS ownership. For now, however, the pair is learning as much as they can, and they continue to work on refining and improving their invention, but hope to pursue formal IP ownership in the future. Okay, let's go to CBC Kids. Bum, 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 bum. The strange legend of the Swedish Yule goat. I'm laughing at this already. Every year in Sweden, a town puts up a giant straw statue of a goat. It's to mark the beginning of the holiday season. They then wait and sometimes bet on whether the goat will make it to Christmas. Because in the town of, if I can pronounce this, Javla, spelled G-A-V-L-E, there's a couple of dots over the A. Well, that's an umlaut or something. Someone always tries to burn down the goat. Why a goat? Well, for hundreds of years, people in Northern Europe have had a big festival in December. They have a lot of festivals. They're known as Yule. These traditions became part of Christmas celebrations in places like Sweden. One of the traditions is the Yule goat. In some stories, Christmas elves would ride the Yule goat door to door to deliver gifts to sleeping children, just like Santa Claus does today. In fact, small goats made of straw are still one of the most popular Christmas decorations in Sweden. So how did it become a yearly tradition? 1966, the town of, see if I can pronounce this again, Javla, okay, I'll take their word for it. The town of Javla wanted something fun and Christmassy for the town square. A giant Yule goat seemed like a great idea. It wasn't. It also wasn't a great idea that the giant statue was made of super flammable straw. Still, the first Javla goat actually made it all the way to New Year's Eve before being burned down. Goat statues in other years haven't been so lucky. In the past 56 years, the Javla Yule goat has been destroyed at least 35 times. So many ways to protect it, so many ways to destroy it. The town has tried lots of different ways to protect their goat. They've had guards stationed, security cameras put up, and fences raised. And the goat itself has been sprayed with water and flame-proof chemicals. Some years, the goat even survives the whole holiday season, but most years, it doesn't. In 2005, a group dressed as Santa and gingerbread men fired flaming arrows into the goat. Hackers in 2009 disabled the security cameras and set the goat on fire. An American tourist was arrested for burning down the goat. In 2001, he said he'd been told by his Swedish friends that burning the goat was okay. He ended up spending 2 weeks in jail. The 50th anniversary of the first Yule goat statue was in 2016. On November 27th, the statue was unveiled. By night, it was up in flames. Some of the strangest attacks. It's not always fire that gets the goat. In 1976, someone drove a car into the back legs of the statue, and it collapsed. Then in 2010, a security guard reported that he had been offered a bribe. Two men planned on using a helicopter to fly away with the goat. The guard turned down the bribe. So why not give up on the goat? The town of Javle is stubborn. Over the years, they've been urged to stop building the goat, or at least stop using the traditional straw. But they're proud of their Yule goat. It has been in the Guinness Book of World Records for its size, not the fires. And every season, people visit the goat and take part in Yule celebrations. Part of the reason people come may be to see how long the goat will last. And some suspect that the town secretly likes all the attention. Still, every year, they promise that the goat will go the distance. Surprisingly, the giant Yule goat was left alone for 5 years. Then in 2021, that streak came to an end when it was burnt to the ground. Let's see if the goat, a Yule goat, makes it this year. Next article, sticking with CBC Kids. Shocking facts about static electricity. Let's see, the article starts right here. So you're walking around the house in your wool socks. You go to open a door and zap, you get shocked. That zap is caused by electricity, the same stuff that powers your video games and shoots out of the sky during a thunderstorm. So what's static electricity? Static electricity is a buildup of electricity in one place. Most electricity flows through a circuit, like when you plug in a lamp, the electricity flows from the plug to the light. But if the electricity has nowhere to go, it stays static. That means that it waits around for a chance to flow out. Why does it happen? Well, everything you see is made up of itty-bitty atoms. Each atom is made up of even more teeny-tiny particles. These particles are called electrons, protons, and neutrons. Think of electrons as a negative sign and the protons as a positive sign. You build up a static charge when two objects touch each other, and the electrons move from one object to the other. One object will become positively charged and the other will become negatively charged. Objects with the same charge will push away from each other. Objects with opposite charges will attract. For example, if you go down a slide, your hair stands up straight. That's because the friction has given your hair a positive charge. They push away from each other. Let's say that you rub your feet on the carpet to get a static charge and then touch something metal like a doorknob. You'll get a zap. Since opposite charges attract, the doorknob discharges your static. So what's the deal with lightning? What is the deal with lightning? It's annoying to get a shock when you touch a doorknob, but when you're outside, lightning can be a dangerous shock. It's just like when you walk across a carpet and get a positive charge. Clouds in the sky can also be positively or negatively charged. But everything likes to be neutral. So if something has become positively or negatively charged, it will try to find balance in the first chance it gets. This is why you might see lightning. Lightning is basically a giant spark jumping from cloud to cloud or cloud to ground. It's moving those electrons around, trying to find balance. So you try it. You can have some fun with static electricity. Take an inflated balloon and rub it on your hair, then put the balloon just above your hair. Nice hairdo. Now try touching the balloon on other objects. Maybe cut up pieces of tissue paper or a tin can on its side or even your sweater. A tin can? Does the balloon attract or push away objects? Can you figure out why? Okay, let's do a little news here. Some CBC Kids news, in fact. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is stepping down. Trudeau has been Prime Minister for 9 years there in Canada. Here's what you need to know. Let's see, he will resign. The announcement comes after months of pressure from other politicians and even members of his own party to step down. He said he will remain Prime Minister until a new Liberal leader is chosen. The Conservatives and NDP said the move is an effort by the Liberals to hold on to power. Okay, after months of mounting pressure to step down, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has announced he will step down. He made the announcement, what is January 6th, at Rideau Cottage in Ottawa. He said he'd been ending his 9 years as Prime Minister to make way for the new leadership in Canada. He will stay on until a new leader is chosen. We've already read that. Let's see who's talking here. I guess this is him saying, I will always be motivated by what is in the best interest of Canadians. The fact is, despite best efforts to work through it, Parliament has been paralyzed for months, he told reporters. Indeed, Trudeau's minority government has struggled to make progress without the support of the other parties in the House of Commons. Trudeau has also requested that Parliament be prolonged until March 24th, meaning Canada's politicians won't sit in the House of Commons until then. The prorogation, is that how you pronounce it, or pause, will allow time for the Liberals to hold a race to select a new leader. With his resignation, Trudeau spoke of his love for Canada, his love for Canadians, and his fighting spirit that led him to this moment. I'm a fighter. Every bone in my body has told me to fight because I care deeply about Canadians. Chrystia Freeland's resignation, the final straw. Trudeau said internal struggles within the party also led to his decision. Various members of parliament asked that he step down over the past several months. the surprise resignation of his finance minister and longtime ally, Chrystia Freeland, in December, was the final public move that led to this moment, said Laurie Turnbull. She's a political science professor at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Turnbull told CBC News Network ahead of the announcement, "This is a long time in coming. We've really seen the pressure on the prime minister build since Chrystia Freeland resigned and left cabinet." Liberals praise Trudeau's milestones. Following Trudeau's resignation announcement, Liberal Party Sachit Mahra praised Trudeau for his long service as Canada's leader. "Liberals across the country are immensely grateful to Justin Trudeau for more than a decade of leadership to our party and country." Let's see here. He credited Trudeau for rebuilding the party and making it the most open and inclusive movement in Canadian politics. He spoke of Trudeau's works in creating affordable child care, his action on climate change, and his work in helping businesses through the pandemic. He also noted Trudeau's efforts in establishing dental care and universal pharmacare. "We thank him for his service to Canada, and we look forward to his continued leadership until a new leader is chosen." Conservatives, NDP, aren't convinced. No. Conservative Party leader Pierre Poilievre, he wasn't as generous in his view of Trudeau's time in power. "Canadians desperate to turn the page on this dark chapter in our history might be relieved today that Justin Trudeau is finally leaving," he said in a news release. With a federal election looming, Poilievre said the resignation announcement was a last-ditch effort for the Liberals to preserve their chances of staying in power. "Every Liberal MP and leadership contender supported everything Trudeau did for 9 years, and now they want to trick voters by swapping in another Liberal face to keep ripping off Canadians for another 4 years," Poilievre said in a post. NDP leader Jagmeet Singh also said that the move wasn't made on account of what was best for Canada, but instead what was best for Liberals' political fate. And I guess it's him talking. "Justin Trudeau's Liberals let down Canadians. They let you down on home prices. They let you down on home care. They let you down by allowing corporate greed to run wild." Both Poilievre and Singh have said that they plan to initiate a non-confidence vote at the earliest opportunity to trigger an election and vie for their own shot to be Canada's next leader. And with that, I'm out of time. This is Bigler for Bigler's World. I'll read with you next week. Until then, bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.